This is Paul Morledge of the UW Oral History Project. Today is Tuesday, May 26, 1998, and I'm in the office of Professor Donald Novotny in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering. And today we're going to start out by talking about Professor Novotny's childhood and early education. Could you briefly describe your childhood and your early years of schooling in Chicago?
Well, I was born in December of 1934 to Adolf and Margaret Novotny. We lived at the time when I was born, the family lived at on the far south side of Chicago at 94th Street and Lyons Avenue in a what was called at the time a three-flat building. We lived on the second level, and actually I think my grandparents lived on the third level. At least they lived nearby. One of the earliest recollections I have at the age of maybe, 3 years old, was sitting and looking out the front room window of our house because we lived right across from a massive railroad track that probably had 20 rails. And there were steam locomotives going by all the time. And I could sit for hours and watch these things go by. There was also a coal yard right in front of our house and a trestle, and these steam locomotives would push trains onto the trestle and then unload coal. So you can imagine the neighborhood was full of coal dust. Everything turned black fairly quickly. I also remember that fairly early on, maybe when I was four or so, my grandmother died of appendicitis. In those days, that was something, if you didn't catch early, was often fatal. A couple years later, my parents bought their own home just a block away at 93rd and Langley Avenue, a single family home. And my aunt actually owned the house next door. And I remember one of the traumatic experiences to me, which may be the reason I'm afraid of heights, I'm not sure, was I recall in looking at the house, we were on the front porch and I leaned against the railing and it broke off and I fell probably 10 feet down to the ground with my uncle trying to catch me. I wasn't hurt, at least I wasn't hurt physically, but I think my fear of high places and bridges may stem from that, I'm not sure. My only brother, only sibling, was born in about 5 years old. He was born in about 1939. I don't have a lot of recollections of childhood, but there are two occurrences that do stay in my mind because they relate to where I ended up, what profession I ended up in. I remember at quite a young age, I plugged in a pair of scissors into the wall outlet and created one whopping spark, and nothing happened to me because the current just went from one blade into the other one. But I think it almost killed my mother. She jumped so badly. And obviously I was curious about what was in that outlet.
There's actually a big spark
Very large spark that occurred. Blew the fuses, put everything in the house out. And actually took about half an inch off the end of one of the blades of the screwdriver.
Wow.
In kind of a melted drip. And then, I don't know whether it was before or after that, I also remember removing a light bulb from a lamp and replacing the bulb with my finger to see what was in there. And that was also very traumatic. That's something you only do once. I've never come anywhere near doing it again. I have no idea whether...
You get a big jolt?
Oh, yeah, you get a terrible, terrible jolt. Just in the tip of your finger for the most part. So it's not actually a danger. Now I realize it's not likely to ever kill you, except by fright. But at the end of your finger gets walloped.
And, wow.
And you feel it all the way up your arm because it travels up the muscle. But those two things, those are traumatic enough that I would remember them, I think. I think I was pretty young, obviously pretty young, 4 or 5 years old. I attended a school called Burnside Elementary School. In Chicago, the schools, many of the schools were very large buildings. This was a five-story, immense brick block building. There were probably a couple thousand students in the school. School actually had not only the first eight grades of what was called elementary school, but also a branch of the high school. So it had a ninth grade as well. So I actually attended it for 9 years. Well, 8 years. I actually skipped two half grades in elementary school. I don't remember which grades. But so I only spent actually 8 years instead of 9 years. At some point, I think around the sixth grade, 1946, somewhere in that range, my mother died of tuberculosis after a long stay in the hospital. That was also a kind of a traumatic thing for both my brother and I, because when she went off to the hospital, we were all told that, you know, she'd be back in some period of time, and of course she never did. And we were not allowed to visit. And we were followed up for years afterward by requiring tuberculin tests. I never showed any. I always showed negative, but my brother tested positive. Nothing ever happened, and they finally gave up on us. My father remarried a couple years later to my mother. My father, by the way, was Czechoslovakian, although not, he was born in the U.S. My mother, however, was Hungarian and was actually born in Hungary. When he remarried a couple years later, he married another Hungarian woman. Actually, we lived in a neighborhood that was almost all Hungarian people, so that's not too unlikely. Her name was Sophie, and she had two children, a boy and a girl. The girl was several years older than I was, and the boy a couple years younger. I never really got along with my father's second wife for some reason. And someplace later on, I think in the early 60s, we had a complete break. And I really never visited her or saw her after about 1960. We just had bad chemistry or something, or else I resented her replacing my mother, I'm not sure. But we just never got along. I attended a high school, a school called Fenger High School, graduated.
Fenger,
F-E-N-G-E-R, which is on the south side of Chicago, about 111th around Halsted Street. I graduated in January of 1952, about number four ranked in the class of 300. Actually, I do remember for sure that I was the number one boy. All the other ones ahead of me were girls. And that was actually pretty amazing, since I was not big on doing homework when I was in high school. The classes were pretty easy. And I kind of coasted along with no trouble and ended up being having the highest GPA of the boys. But it caught up with me when I tried to enter college. There was a pretty clear indication that the Chicago high schools were not on a par with some of the other schools around the country that fed into the same colleges.
You mean from like standardized testing?
Yeah, from standardized testing or placement tests. I mean, I actually received some kind of a medal for having the highest math course grades in high school. And when I tried to enter IIT, my placement tests put me in remedial math, which I argued my way out. The counselor talked to me and said, look, according to this, you have very good aptitude and you have terrible preparation. What's going on? And I said, I don't know. I work here. And then, so he let me go in to the regular math class. Actually, along in high school somewhere, I began to work somewhat with my father. My father was a heating system serviceman, primarily oil burner equipment. He worked for a company that worked on not only home domestic oil burners, but also big industrial oil burners. But I used to go along with him on weekends and so on, and I kind of enjoyed it. I got along very well with my father. And I slowly came to kind of like that kind of activity, the technical, at least the knowing how to fix things was something that became of great interest to me. And I think probably this is, in fact, what got me into engineering in the first place, and ultimately into electrical engineering. By the time I was maybe a junior in high school, my father had left that company and formed a little company of his own and was selling, had a little storefront and was selling equipment to other servicemen. And he had a lot of personal customers that he had built up through the years, and he sort of gave them to me. And I became, at the age of 17 or something like that, a self-employed service person. Today, one would never do that because of the potential liability, if nothing else. Yeah, but it was very lucrative compared to what I could make in any kind of a typical job. By the way, my regular job prior to that was a pin setter, setting pins in a bowling alley, which I made about four times as much as my wife. She wasn't my wife at the time, but she had a little selling job. I think she got 50 cents an hour or 40 cents an hour, and I was getting close to $2 an hour setting pins. Of course, it was very hard work.
Well, yeah, imagine.
Jeez. Yes, very hard work. But at any rate, I had a few customers that I took care of. My father took care of them, too, when he had time, and otherwise I took care of them if I was closer by. But also, he at one point, and this is one of my favorite stories about what got me turned on to engineering, there was a certain part in the oil burner that was the primary, the most likely place for trouble to occur, because it was the most complicated. And my father had an authorized exchange service for Minneapolis Honeywell Company. Guys would bring these in and just exchange them for a rebuilt one, and then the older ones go back to be rebuilt. Well, I found out that I looked at a lot of these, and he looked at them and said, you know, these look perfect. I don't look like there's anything wrong with them. So we built a test board, to see if these things worked, and about 8 out of 10 of them worked. So it really meant the guys didn't know what else to do, so they changed one of these things. And at any rate, I no longer ever sent any back. I just swapped ones that people brought in that were in good condition, and I gave people a good deal on them and told them they weren't rebuilt, but they were worked. Also got into the point of finding out what was wrong with these things, and I got to swapping parts from one to another and making making one good one out of four bad ones, things like that. Mm. And sometimes, every once in a while, I would send back one of these ones that I had swapped out all the parts. And I got to thinking that somewhere back at Minneapolis Honeywell, was some young engineer studying these things to find out why they were failing. And then he'd get one where everything failed at once. This is the one that I had worked on and taken all the parts out. So I suspect that I was really messing up their quality control, or at least their examination of what was making these things go wrong. But I was learning a great deal, and I had a wonderful experience along the line.
You were what age then?
Was about 18, yeah. And I continued to do this all during the time that I went on to the university, to the IIT. I continued that occupation. I should remark that, I think about 1951, maybe junior year, I met my future wife, Louise, at a football game. And, I never had any thought that, well, actually, I went to the game by myself, and she came home with her, and I've had her ever since, so to speak. When I graduated, I graduated in January of 1952. Louise, my wife, was in the June class. They graduated twice a year in Chicago. And I didn't have the money to go on to college. So I actually took a job at the Illinois Central Railroad as a tinsmith apprentice. And that, it turned out to be 6 months, no, 8 months. 8 months was probably the worst experience of my life, because all the journeymen were willing to teach me was how to look busy without doing anything, so that the boss wouldn't be upset. I got into trouble once because they gave me a job that was off by myself, and it was building a certain thing, and I just worked at a leisurely pace, and I ended up building three times as many as the journeyman thought I should have built, and I was setting a new standard for them to meet, and they got very upset with me. Well, fortunately, it wasn't a lifetime career for me. I don't know why this happened, but at the time, I had not received any kind of a fellowship when I graduated, but sometime while I was at the IC Illinois Central, I received a 4-year tuition fellowship to any school that I chose from the George M. Pullman Foundation. I remember that you had to have somebody in your family who had worked at the Pullman Company, and somewhere we found a relative who had. And I succeeded in receiving this fellowship, which allowed me to go to school in the fall.
You sought this Pullman scholarship out, or they found you?
No, somebody at the high school called it to my attention.
Oh, the guidance counselor. What a good student you were, yeah. And that you should be going to college, but yes. You didn't have the means to do it.
Right. Oh, something like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I can't recall exactly. I then left the railroad and went to IIT in Chicago, starting the program in August or September of 1952. You want to put a footnote in here, Paul?
So, Professor Novotny, why did you decide to enroll at the Illinois Institute of Technology?
Well, it was actually very, very simple. I had the full tuition fellowship, and I could live at home.
Oh, it was near the campus. Yeah,
it was
near
your close home. Enough to my house. We lived at 93rd. The campus was at 33rd, so it was about 7 miles to school. I also knew by that time that I wanted to study engineering, and most likely electrical engineering. Based upon this work with my father and some of the things I had done in high school. So the closest engineering school was IIT. I had also read and so on that it was generally recognized as a good school, a strong school. So those are the principal reasons.
Did you consider any other institutions?
Not at that point.
Okay.
Not at that point. I've already mentioned that when I went in, in my placement tests, I almost had to take remedial math, but did not actually. And I did quite well at the school. I don't remember what class rank I had, but it was up near the top, maybe fourth or fifth or something like that. It might have even been higher. I totally enjoyed the engineering courses, and I tolerated the other things that I had to do. The worst course that I took was a course I had to take. I had to take some kind of elective in liberal studies, and somebody told me to take this psychology course. And the only thing I can say for it is I found a book that whenever I couldn't sleep, all I had to do was open it and read a little bit, and I would fall asleep. For the most part, I enjoyed I enjoyed the time there. IIT is strictly a commuting campus. Almost everybody lives off campus. It's also not in a very nice part of Chicago. It's kind of a run-down neighborhood. That didn't bother me. The campus itself is very nice.
Does it still extend today?
Still stands today. It's still considered a good school. It's a little bigger than it used to be. It has a big research operation associated with it. So I have no qualms about having gone there. It has, you know, it's the kind of a place, though, if you try to hold a school dance, the enrollment of women was so small that you had to hold the dance in conjunction with the local nursing school or something. In order to get a few people from both sexes into the dance floor. And there's no football team, nothing like that. There are some sports, but it's totally, totally different than the Madison, the University of Wisconsin. In 1954, Louise and I were married. That was between my sophomore and junior years. The plan was, and she had a job, she was working full time, and the plan was to work, she would continue to work until I graduated, and then we would start a family and do all the other things married people do. Our first apartment was on 117th Street, a little further south in Chicago, pretty close to the high school we both went to, and closer to her family. That just happens to be where we found a place, I guess. And then, as luck would have it, your plans don't always work. In August, 2-3 months after we were married, Louise was struck with polio. And this was 1954. The polio vaccine came up in 55 or 56, I think. So she was amongst the last groups that suffered that disease. She actually made a full recovery after quite a long time. Oh, by long, I mean 6 or 8 months, something like that. She was, the doctor that we had never hospitalized her because he said there really wasn't much the hospital could do that we couldn't do at home. And he knew we didn't have any money. So in the morning, before I went to school, I would carry her up out of bed and into the living room and turn the TV on and so on. And then I'd rush home after school and do the cooking and whatever. We had a lot of help from our parents, of course, etc. But it was a trying time. We got through that, and I continued at school. I didn't drop any classes or anything. And then, of course, our plans still weren't working because in 1955, our first child arrived in November of 1955. And then, at that point, we were in a real mess for money because Louise hadn't been able to work. And I had been working part-time on Saturdays. I had a wonderful job with an oil company. By now, remember, I was almost a senior in engineering school. I had a job with an oil company. On Saturdays, I would go out to the customers that their regular servicemen had not been able to fix and not been able to get the equipment working in their homes. And most of the time, these were electrical problems. And I was able to, with one exception, over 2 years, get them all to work, get them all fixed. Actually, the biggest job was getting in the house because the previous guys had not given them any satisfaction. But that was a great deal of fun. I really enjoyed that.
So then I take it IIT gave you very hands-on education.
We had lots of lab work, but most of the hands-on stuff came via my father.
Oh, okay, and from fixing those...
And then the electrical, the knowledge I had in electrical engineering now cleared up for me some of the things I didn't understand before and that my father didn't understand about why these things did what they did. So I could almost always find the difficulty. In fact, the one I didn't find wasn't electrical, it was an acoustic noise problem, and I simply could not get the oil burner to be quiet, no matter what I did. Right at about this time, though, when we were really in a problem with money, this was the beginning of my senior year, and looked like I was going to have to drop out for a semester or something. In about October of that year, there came a deluge to Chicago. I mean, a rainstorm you wouldn't believe, and it flooded a good two-thirds of the city. Basements all over the city were full of water. And so I called up all my customers, my personal customers, and told them not to turn their furnace on. And I went out and took the motor off and brought it home, and Louise washed it out with a solvent and baked it dry in our oven. and I was getting 10 or 12 bucks a piece, which in those days was a lot of money. But a new motor was like 50, 40. So I was saving customers lots of money, and I was making lots of money. Also, you could not buy a motor in the city of Chicago. They were gone. You know, they were all used up. My father had some in the store, and he let me have, I don't know, 30 or 20 or something that I sold. And in the span of 2 months, I made enough money to finish my senior year of school. So I always like that story because it says, you know, in every cloud there's a silver lining. Everybody else was in bad shape, and for me, the sun was shining.
Almost literally.
Almost literally, yeah. Now, I graduated in June.
Wait, before you get on to graduation, or maybe you were going to just touch on it, but were there any courses, fellow students that are instructors that influenced you at IIT in your undergraduate years?
Yes, there was a math teacher, I think, that had a significant influence on me because of just his attitude toward teaching. I thought he was a terrific teacher. And I had some people that weren't very good teachers. I don't even remember his name anymore, but he was terrific. And then there was a professor in electrical engineering that I got to know very well, by the name of Elton Jones. And he had a significant influence on me. He was the one who kind of pushed me toward graduate work. But those are the main ones, I think. There were several that whose influence was negative. I mean, who I looked at what they did and said, I'm not going to do that.
Oh, right. you saw what they were doing and you realized, no, I don't want to do that.
And I don't want to, that's not something a good teacher should do. For example, that if I ever teach, I won't do that. And I probably have, but at the time I didn't want to. When I graduated in June, well, in fact, the whole spring there, the senior year, there happened to be a time when there were jobs galore. This was 1956. There were jobs for engineers. You know, I couldn't believe how many there were, and I took interviews all over the country. I had a good time traveling around. I had so many offers that I didn't know what to do. And Louise didn't know what to do. She wasn't keen about moving off a long way. And then I was offered, well, I had offered also, I had been offered a very nice fellowship to do a year of for a master's degree. And since I couldn't decide what job I wanted, I decided to do a master's degree. And that's actually about the way it is, the way it was. I don't think at the time I had any thoughts of ever doing graduate work. Nobody in my family had ever gone to college. I was the first one, and why would I have had any thoughts of going beyond a four-year degree? I really went on that first year because I couldn't make up my mind which of the many jobs I was offered I really wanted. And we moved our home a little bit. We didn't move. We moved to get a little more room, actually. And I had a little more money. Although I remember my fellowship was $278 a month. And we lived on that quite well, as a matter of fact. I worked part-time on weekends and so on. But I finished the master's degree in 1 year. I did my thesis in power systems. I had to choose where to do the thesis. And power was what I wanted, power engineering as opposed to communication engineering, as opposed to radios and radar and things like that.
Back then, that's the way the field that's was the way it divided. Divided.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was kind of electronics and power. The power systems thesis was not something that I chose because I was particularly enamored with power systems, but the one of the professors there was very demanding, forceful, and convinced me that he had this wonderful project that I should do with him. And it was interesting. It was a project on a study of whether or not you could use the power system, the wires of the power system, as a means for signaling people of disaster potential, things like hurricanes and tornadoes and whatever, rather than having sirens, could you have in everybody's home plugged into the outlet somewhere, little buzzer-like things that could be signaled from the main location in the power system, which is kind of a neat idea. It turns out that it doesn't really work because in order to cover a very wide area, it takes a tremendous amount of power to do it. And if you want to cut the power down, then you also cut down the area you can cover tremendously. You have to go to higher frequencies. So the study pretty much showed it wasn't a good idea. That was feasible, but not a good idea. Well, once again, when I graduated, I had the same problem, that there were so many jobs, I didn't know what to do.
Really, you just had so many job offers. There were job offers. You're paralyzed.
You're paralyzed, that's right. I was paralyzed with knowing what to do. And I remember traveling out to Schenectady, to General Electric, and traveling to Westinghouse, to Pittsfield, Massachusetts, and traveling all over and having these job offers. And again, I just didn't know which one to take. And that's when this one
Elton Jones asked you to stay another year. Mm-hmm.
Yes, he suggests, or he said, why don't you consider staying another year? You can take a couple courses, and we can make you an instructor. In those days, they actually did appoint people without PhDs to teaching positions, and they didn't just, now they call them always teaching assistants, but in those days they called them instructors. And we can make you an instructor, he said, and you can spend the next year figuring out what job you want to take. So that seemed like a neat way out of my dilemma, and Louise was fine with that, so I did that. And I taught one section of the first course for engineers, electrical engineers, course on circuit theory. And I taught a course for non-electrical, mechanical engineers. But after a couple of weeks in class, I just found this to be the most fun thing I'd ever done in my life.
Teaching.
Teaching, to try to explain these things. And even my colleagues have always felt that teaching non-electrical engineers about electrical engineering is terrible. But I found it to be really a neat thing, a challenge, to get these guys interested and to present it in some way that they could understand. I also, in passing, also remember I was given, I think the second semester, the IIT had an architecture school. And I was given a task to teach electrical engineering to architects. Well, that is not fun, because architects are not engineers. They typically have almost no mathematics, not interested in mathematics, and they are kind of more artists than they are engineers.
Right.
And I found, here's the second semester I ever taught, I found my tongue totally tied by not being able to use mathematics to describe what I wanted to tell them about. And I had to invent all these crazy ways of explaining things, which was drawing pictures. Basically, I had to do everything by drawing pictures.
Can you give an example?
One example is most of the power we use electrically is delivered by alternating current. That means the current goes first one way and then the other way,
mm-hmm.
alternately, and it's sort of shaped like a sinusoid or like a smooth curve. There is a number associated with that wave that tells you how much heat it can generate. It's called the effective value of the current. It requires squaring and integrating and averaging, which is our three mathematical operations they have no idea. So the only thing I could do was to draw pictures, to actually draw a picture of the squared wave, to draw a picture, and to show how it could be averaged by cutting off the high parts and putting them in the low parts so that it came out flat, things like that. It was a challenge, but it was not the kind of challenge that I, first of all, they didn't particularly like it. They didn't want to have to know about this stuff. And I finally asked myself, why do architects need to know this stuff? If they, as long as they know that you can't make the walls 1 inch thick and have power on the second floor, that's probably enough. Huh? And so then I began to look for things that would turn them on. And I finally got the class all excited because at the time somebody had invented these phosphorescent panels that when you energize them with electricity, they glow. They're now used for, nothing ever came of them, but at the time they thought they were going to be big deals. You make whole walls of them, and you could, by using different frequencies, you could dial up different colors of walls. And, that turned on the architects, as you can imagine.
Right.
But except for that, I really got turned on by teaching. And I think I apparently was pretty good at it because the students did well.
Even the architecture students.
Even the architecture students, when I finally found something they were interested in.
Did you enjoy trying to find out a way to reach the architects?
Yes, but that was really a stretch. That was such a stretch. I found that not being able to describe these things with mathematics made my progress so slow in getting these ideas across that it was a frustration. So that course was very frustrating.
Probably allowed you a lot of creativity, though, too.
Oh, yeah, it did. Yeah. But it was a frustrating thing because you moved so slowly. At any rate, I suddenly, at some point there, I don't know, somewhere along in that first semester, realized that people made their living doing what I was doing and teaching, and that I thought I would like that. So I talked to some people there on the faculty, and one of the things they told me, of course, was, well, if you want to do that, then you have to go on for a PhD. Well, that was... You know, here I am, as I said, the first in my family to get a bachelor's degree, and all of a sudden I'm talking about a PhD. Also, you know, making my wife struggle along there she was a student wife now for quite a few years already, 3, and now we're talking 5 or 6, 8 years maybe. But she was willing to go along with it if that was what I wanted. So I... sent out to, we decided we didn't want to leave the Midwest. Both of us were from Chicago. I'd never been anywhere else. So
I had family there, too.
And we had family there. So I wrote to all the Midwestern schools, Illinois, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Indiana, Michigan, maybe Purdue, I don't remember. And got applications. No, I didn't have that kind of money.
It does.
Yeah. So I sent off applications to all these schools, particularly to be a teaching assistant or to be an instructor.
Oh, you applied to be an instructor, not a student?
Yeah, well, both.
Oh, okay.
Both. I applied to be a student, that would be no problem because my grade record was very good, et cetera.
Well, so you knew you'd get into all these schools.
I knew I could get into the schools,
but
yeah.
To get the instructor.
But I needed a job. And I, at that time, schools were still making, I say, instructorship offers. So actually, I had offers from, as far as I can remember, almost all the schools to come. It was a time when all the schools were greatly expanding their PhD programs, and so they were looking for students, PhDs in engineering. So they were looking to add students. So I had all these offers, and then, of course, the question is, and a significant question now is, since these are all good schools, why did I choose Wisconsin? And I have to admit that the reason, the most telling reason was, two things. One, it was a reasonable shot from Chicago. But very importantly was I got a map of the city of Madison and I laid it down and found out it was lakes all around it. And since I love to fish and to be out of doors and so on, and when I looked at Illinois, there was nothing around it but corn and so on. And so it was largely the environment, the environs, the physical environment, because I had been told that Wisconsin was a very good school. and as was Illinois and Minnesota and so on, that they all had good EE programs. People said probably Illinois had the best. Well, they had the biggest, but I don't know. But anyway, I ended up choosing it pretty much on the basis of personal reasons rather than purely academic reasons. So in, this is now the end of 1957, in about June of 58, we moved Madison to Wisconsin. At that time, Chicago to Madison. At that time, the trip from Chicago to Madison was non-trivial. There were no freeways. It was all two-lane highway. So it took, I don't know, 5 or 6 hours to get up here. My wife, when she saw how far away we were and how country-ish it was, she wondered where I was taking her out of the big city. We moved into university houses, faculty housing here on the Madison campus. Beautiful, beautiful area at the time, just a block off Lake Mendota.
Over
behind what's now Eagle Heights. It's up on the hill west of Eagle Heights. Beautiful, beautiful place. All, young people working on their, you had to be on the faculty, so they were either instructors or assistant professors, and you can only stay there for 4 or 5 years, and you have to move. And actually, the friendships we made there when we moved in, the people that we met and got to know in those 4 years I think we were there, are still our closest friends. They're now all over the country, but we visit them regularly and so on. There's still a couple in Madison. So it was a great place. And I had a job as a full-time instructor to start in the fall of 58. For the summer of, I couldn't afford not to do anything in the summer of 57, so I continued as an instructor at IIT and commuted back and forth between Madison and Chicago. Not every day.
Oh, excuse me.
I commuted. I think I taught 3 days a week. They arranged so I could meet my classes Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And so then on Monday and Friday, I drove and I had the weekend here at home. But it was not something I would want to do for a very long time. That's for sure.
I was going to add one thing about living in the faculty-student housing. Must have been a pretty stimulating environment, too.
Oh, yes.
Given all your neighbors were into for very specialized fields. And
It's an extremely stimulating place. People there from all disciplines, they had all kinds of activities went on, picnics and Memorial Day affairs. And we had, I remember, a babysitting pool, I guess you called it. We babysat for each other because nobody had the money to hire anybody. And so I babysat for some of the very well-known, faculty around the campus when I was, for their children, when we lived in university houses. It was a great place. It was also a very fertile place. There were an army of kids running every which way. And actually, we added to our family a year after we got here, second child, Cynthia, born, I think in 59, approximately. But the number of children and the extent to which that community kind of belonged to the kids made it a great place to raise kids and a great place to make friends. I do remember, though, when I came here, the first few weeks in the department, in the fall of 58, I was, suffering great pangs of homesickness and the feeling that I had made the wrong decision in doing all this. Here was a campus, even in those days, I don't know how many students it had, but it was enormous compared to what I was used to. Had probably five times as many, and same way, same five times as many faculty. The people I met and the people I started to work with were extremely friendly. But I still had this feeling of that I had made a bad mistake, that I should have done something else. And it persisted for probably 6 months. I do remember it was a kind of a bleak period. Felt really like I should have gone home. That was a problem too, by the way. That was the cause of the final breakup. When we used to go home, particularly after we had two kids, when we'd go home for the holidays or something, there were always terrible fights between the two families as to, you know, where we should spend our time. And that's what finally caused me to just give up on my stepmother. And that solved the problem. So there, you know, moving away into a new environment like that, despite the fact that you're doing what you want to do, or technically what you want to do in terms of your career, all of those experiences made it pretty tough for a while. I would say 6 months. I was given assignments, though, to teach courses that were of great interest to me. They were courses in power engineering, principally courses in electrical machines and applications of machines. They were required courses for all electrical engineers, and that was a negative because some of the fellows couldn't care less about that particular subject. So there was quite a challenge to get them to be reasonably interested in what you were talking about. A little bit like the architects, but at least I could use mathematics. My teaching loads at the time, I was a full-time instructor, teaching loads were what were called 12 credits. That meant two three-hour-a-week lectures, and three three-hour-a-week labs. The labs counted two-thirds. So the two lectures counted as six hours, and each lab counted as two. So I was a pretty busy guy. I had two lectures three times a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, I expect. And then I had these labs in the afternoon. So, and then I was allowed to take a half-time load as a graduate student. So I was taking often two courses myself. I always remember the first day I came on campus, and the associate chairman, or the chairman maybe, Harold Peterson, took me down to a room here on the second floor and said, "You can use that desk here." And there were three or four desks in the room, and there was also a sink and a bunch of bookcases. And there was one chap in the room huddled over something at his desk working. He didn't even look up. No, I guess he did. I guess he introduced me. Harold introduced me to Charles Mersch, who became a very good friend. And then Charlie went back to his work, and I was arranging my desk. And all of a sudden, there was this tremendous noise. I don't know how to describe it. A great, great, horrid, sizzling noise. And then this cloud of steam came over me, and particles fell down. And it turns out that Charlie routinely did this. He made coffee in an aluminum pot, and the aluminum pot, after a while, picked up a lot of lime inside of it. And the way he got it out was to put it on the burner and heat it till it was glowing, and then take it over to the sink, which he had filled with water, and smash it into the water. And this differential temperature change would crackle all this stuff out, and it would come flying off like a volcano. Only it was fine. It worked just fine, and we did it from there on. But he never told me he was going to do it. And the sink was only about 2 feet from my head. But Charlie turned out to be an extraordinarily good friend.
Charlie Mersch. Mersch.
Mm-hmm. He moved from here out to Colorado, and spent many years working for an aerospace company there in Colorado. He's now retired, lives on the south side of Denver. And I visit him whenever I get out to Colorado.
Wasn't Ball Aerospace by chance, was it?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, I
went to college there, that sort of
thing. I see. Within the first year or so, I had to do some thinking about, you know, who would be my thesis advisor. And I considered a number of faculty here based upon having taken courses from them and so on. But I finally selected Professor Norbert Schmitz as my thesis advisor. Norb was, I don't think I had a class from him, but he's one that was teaching the same courses I was teaching. And his area of expertise was electrical machine modeling and machine control. And he had a lot of practical experience. He worked a number of years at, I think, Square D, a company in Milwaukee. And he posed to me a problem that I thought was very interesting, which had to do with operating a motor in a way that would greatly increase the power density, the watts, the power per pound, out of the machine. But when people tried to run it in that mode, it gave an instability. It looked like it should work, but it didn't. There was something wrong with it dynamically. And he said, why don't you figure out what's wrong and figure out some way to make it stable? And so that's what I chose to do for my PhD thesis. And I think we got started on it in about late part of 59, or maybe early 59, and finished it in 61, a couple of years, 2-3 years it took to get it done. Turns out that the basic idea that we had to stabilize it from the beginning was okay. The problem was building it properly and building fabricating devices that would do what we needed. And we managed to do that. I had two very close colleagues, two other graduate students, that worked on spin-offs of my thesis. They're Vern Albertson, who's currently a professor at the University of Minnesota, and John Law. Always liked that name, but John Law got his PhD here also and is a professor at the University of Idaho. And actually, Joe Law, John Law's son, also got a PhD here fairly recently. Both of them worked, Vern particularly worked with me because his thesis was an extension of mine. So he was kind of my helper all during the time I did my work. And John Law took a particular piece of my work and expanded it into another project. Now, in those days, you had to put in a year of full-time study. You couldn't be a teacher the whole time. That rule stayed in effect here at Madison up until last year or so. But now it's been modified. Well, the question was clearly how was I going to fund a year where I had no income? And then along came, it's not another flood. Another flood would have been useful, but there wasn't another flood. Along came the Ford Foundation, actually, and they instituted a fellowship program, which was really a forgivable loan program for people who were interested in a university teaching career. They would give you a fellowship and also a loan, and the loan was forgivable at a certain percentage, a certain fraction every year you maintained a teaching position. So that looked like a pretty good, that looked very reasonable to me because that's what I wanted to do, so that's what I did. I received the Ford Foundation Forgivable Loan Fellowship somewhere around 1959, and spent the year of 1960 as a full-time student. Let me pause a minute. Let's pause. So it was actually also about the time of this full-time year that we had our second child. I mentioned that before. Two children. And actually, Louise went to had a part-time job for part of that period. Again, to make ends meet. One of the most difficult tasks that I had in the PhD program was actually the foreign language requirement. At the time, you had to have a reading knowledge of two foreign languages. So I chose the typical two, French and German. And the way the exam ran, you could, whenever you wanted to take the exam, you signed up and they provide a faculty member to sit with you and quiz you about reading some kind of document. Well, it took me a long time because language is simply not something that I ever had ever had any interest in. And it was a great struggle. I must also confess that I don't think I ever used it that I can think of, except to find the men's room in Germany. That was useful, I suppose, things like that. But I never really read any serious German literature, German papers. Maybe that's unfair because I have tried to dig things out of German articles, and mostly I can do it from the mathematics. But apparently I can also read enough of the sentences, read enough of the material around there to be helpful. So I shouldn't say I never used it, but it's been of marginal value.
So they had you learn two foreign languages because a lot of the engineering
literature was
European?
Yep. That was the argument, that so much of the technical literature was in German especially. French was just easy, relatively speaking. It's much more like English. German is all backwards. The sentence structure is all backwards compared to English.
Was Polish an option?
No, there were a half a dozen languages that were available, but you had to... and if you wanted to do one that was not on the list, you could make an argument. Russian was another popular one at the time.
Oh, yeah, imagine rendering Russian would be very...
That was a very popular one. One of the other requirements was a minor in mathematics. Mine was in mathematics. That turned out to be no problem. I like mathematics. But I did find an interesting thing. When the last course I took, we began to do mathematics that, to me, made no sense. Because... He began to ask questions like, you know, prove that 1 + 1 = 2. And I didn't know where more basic to go to get something to prove that was. So I was at a level now, as far as my engineering interests were concerned, that there wasn't much point in going beyond. And that's probably appropriate. Maybe that's why we ended there. I don't know. But that was the last math course I took was the only math course I ever took that I didn't like.
Did you ever try to prove why 1 + 1
is? Yeah, I figured out how to do it, but I have no idea. I don't remember anymore. I would never remember anymore
how to do that. One little glimpse of it, huh?
No. And then the other thing that we had to do was to take what was called at the time a preliminary exam. And it was an exam with 4 or 5 engineering EE faculty. And you gathered in a room, and you were at the blackboard. The person being examined was at the blackboard, and then they would ask you questions in the subject matter that you had studied to prepare yourself for this exam. And the preliminary term meant just that there was another one coming afterward. Called the qualifying exam. I don't remember which term was which. Anyway, the story I wanted to tell was there was one faculty member on that committee who I mentioned by name is Glenn Kaler. He's been dead now for many years. But Glenn was an older professor when I came, you know, much older. He was probably old enough to be my grandfather or, yeah, at least. But I did find out early on that he liked to fish. And he was kind of an expert on the lakes down here. So I befriended him early on. And we used to, and he became a good friend, and we would go fishing together. And pretty much like a grandfather and a grandson might go fishing. And in this prelim exam, I don't know, I guess that he decided, well, I'd better show these other faculty members that despite the fact that this young guy is my friend, that he's not going to get an easy question out of me. So he asked me this horrendous question, which I couldn't even understand the question to begin with. So he proceeded to help me.
Proceeded to help you during the preliminary?
Yeah, to give me clues on how to proceed with the question. And led me along, and everything was coming along. And then all of a sudden, obviously, there was something wrong because the answer was not going to come out reasonable. And he sat there for a while. He said, I see. He said, I gave you the wrong thing back there a little ways. I gave you the wrong identity. So he didn't mean to, but he just did it. And so we fixed it up and we got along. Well, actually, I was pretty well rattled at that point. I think he might have been the first one. But the rest of the faculty settled me down, and I managed to pass the exam. And I guess he was just... it may have been that it was appropriate at that stage to let a young whippersnapper know that he didn't know everything about electrical engineering. It was a pretty trying experience. We really don't have that exam anymore. That's also gone away for a different format where the student sits down individually with a number of faculty with nobody looking on. And I don't know which is better, but I do know that it gave me a certain degree of humbleness about my ability. One would think that somebody who had taught as many years as I had would not be likely to become rattled just up at the blackboard, but I did. In fact, I remember being rattled even before he asked me the question. I think it's rather intimidating to have five faculty. Maybe that's why we did away with the exam. It's in that format. It's better maybe to have people visit individual faculty in their office. It's less intimidating, and you maybe know better, have a better feeling for what the person really knows about the subject, and not so much about how well he can manage himself, control himself in a trying situation.
So now students go in with one faculty member, and the faculty member drills them.
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, okay.
And you get to choose half of the faculty members yourself. You get to say, you get to pick like 10, and they give you 5. And then they also pick 5. The computer picks 5. Random. Well, at any rate, most of this study time was very pleasant. Enjoyed the courses, and certainly enjoyed the teaching. The full-time year, I don't remember as well. I remember more the teaching years for some reason. I do remember, however, in I think April of 1960, I got a call from Chicago to tell me that my father had died. At a very young age, 52, he was. He had a heart attack in a spring snowstorm. Well, that delayed my graduation by probably one semester. I couldn't work very well for a while. We had to spend a lot of time in Chicago. But finally, I don't know. I didn't look up and know exactly. My degree is somewhere in 1961. I think it's in August of 61. I actually had an opportunity to spend a summer working at the Aerospace Corporation in California, El Segundo, California, south of Los Angeles. There was a colleague of mine, Professor Joe Wirtz, also working at Aerospace. I don't remember if at the time Joe was actually employed there or was also working a summer. Mine was just a summer job, and I kind of took it pretty much as an opportunity to get away for a while and see what industry was like for a PhD. I was asked when I was there to work with a group that were actually doing some very initial researchy type design of a forerunner of our recoverable rocket, of our Challenger and so on. Up to that time, all rockets were expended. They dumped them into the sea after they did their job. And we were looking into the possibility of building with that kind of technology of the early 60s, a recoverable rocket. It was very, very preliminary. It was called the Flying Anvil, because that was the kind of aerodynamics that it had. It's a real problem to build that kind of vehicle, because what you need going up as a rocket and what you need coming back as an airplane are very different by way of configuration of the plane. You really don't want wings on a rocket. And you got to have wings on a gliding aircraft coming back. So some of our prototypes were wings that folded in and folded out and so on. It was very interesting, and the most interesting part of the time was the group meetings once a week of the various groups working on the various parts of this project. There were people working on the engine, people working on the fuselage, people working on the fuel tanks, etc. Once a week we got together, and there was a leader, and this leader was the most astounding person that I had ever met. Most astounding person I had ever met up until that time, because he had an extraordinary command of all the technology and all the technical details that were going on in these groups. That is,
he knew what
was going on in each group. And when we met, he sometimes would solve the problem these guys were coming in to say, we don't know what, we're stuck, we don't know what to do, and he'd make a suggestion.
Without ever hearing it before, just right there on the spot.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was just astounding. And I came to realize that some of the people that head up groups like engineering groups like this, and research groups like this, are truly extraordinary individuals that have an immense breadth of knowledge of technology kinds of things. My task was just to assist along the way. What we did was we actually made a simulation of the device as it was currently planned and tried to fly it on a computer just by simulation. And most of the times we found that we couldn't. We crashed. We just didn't have enough skill to fly that thing back. It was an interesting time, but I found, I had full-time option, I could work full-time on technical things, I had no other commitments, but I found that I had, I missed the classroom. I also, during that time, was taking interviews. Prior to that time, and took a lot of interviews, different places, and again had lots of opportunities. One became very serious in my mind, and that was a job as a research director of a new group at the Carrier Corporation, out east, Rochester maybe, New York, I forget, somewhere like that.
And Carrier air conditioners.
Carrier air conditioners. Mm-hmm. And I was extremely interested in that job because they wanted to set up a group, and I would be ahead of it, to design and build the next generation of drive motors and drive systems for their big air conditioning equipments. And this meant state-of-the-art stuff. Power electronics was just beginning to appear at this time. I haven't mentioned that yet, but I will. The area that I was working in here of machines and so on, power control, was experiencing an enormous potential change with the development of transistor-like devices that could handle large amounts of power. Prior to this time, see, the first transistors were developed when I was about a sophomore in college. And they were what are called point contact transistors, and they had almost no capacity to carry current. But along about this time, around this early 60s, devices that could carry large amounts of current and therefore control motors and automobiles and things like that were just becoming available. So there was going to be, in the next 10 or 15 years, a revolution. And this would have been a chance to be in on that, sort of on the ground floor, with a major firm. Yes?
Can I just ask one thing? Power electronics, can you explain that? I guess
I just did, in a way. Power electronics simply means utilizing electronic devices like transistors to control large amounts of electric power.
To control where the power goes.
Control where it goes, or to change its frequency to make it oscillate faster or slower.
Okay, and before the electronics
couldn't do that.
Power was just...
You couldn't do that. All you could do was turn it on and off with a big switch.
Huh.
And the power electronics now, in effect, power electronics is a switch. But it's a switch that you can open and close at a very high rate.
Like a logic gate?
It's like a logic gate, but it controls large amounts of power.
Huh.
And you can flip an electronic switch open and closed at maybe 10,000 times a second.
Wow.
Whereas a regular switch, you know, it takes 10 seconds to open and close it.
So 10 kilohertz.
Yes, 10 kilohertz control modulation of a power switch is what we do nowadays to control motors and various anything, the power supplies in computers, all those things.
Okay.
And this area, this discipline of power electronics was just being initiated in the 60s. In fact, I think when I was a PhD student, we got our first power device, some samples sent out from GE or Westinghouse. They were about the size of the end of your thumb, and they could handle 10 amperes, which is enough to light 10 light bulbs. So things were going to be happening. And I also interviewed at General Electric and at Westinghouse. Aerospace made me some kind of offer. And I had an offer to stay at Madison as an assistant professor. And I finally...
Who made that offer? Was it Dean Wendt?
Harold Peterson, who was the chairman at the time.
Oh, okay.
And I finally decided to accept the assistant professor position here at a salary of $8,500 for the academic year. Okay, in 1961. Now, it's interesting, I remember talking to my father at some time when I was in high school, and he said, if you ever get to making $10,000 a year, you'll have it made. So here I was. Okay, I had it made. Two things about that, though. First of all, the original offer was $8,000, I remember. And I held out in Harold Peterson's office for an additional $500, which is not like me, but I did, and he did. The other part of that is I remember the offer from Carrier to be that research director was at a salary of $16,000.
Back then, that was a lot.
And that was a lot of money.
And it was translating now. What would that be about? Probably $60,000. I don't know.
That's 1961. So this is 1990. 28 years. It's
$100,000.
More than $100,000. More than 100,000. At that point, my wife said, no question about it, she said, we'll be here forever. And it turns out she was right. At the time, I didn't necessarily agree with her, but she had decided that if I was going to... And actually, two reasons for that, three. The way that job at Carrier looked in terms of technical challenge, the city where it was also very nice, and they had a kind of a campus-like environment.
What city was this?
It was somewhere in the east. I think it might have been Rochester, New York. And thirdly, the salary that, you know, was sort of hard to turn down. But she had decided that if I was willing to, you know, sort of take half the salary in order to be involved in a teaching position, that probably we would be there, I would be in that environment forever. And she's been right. And I really don't have any misgivings about it at all, because a lot of people have asked me, well, how could you possibly have stayed in one place at the same job all those years? And I said, well, I stayed in one place, there's no question about that, but I haven't had the same job. I said, one thing about a university environment is that you can have the same title in the same office and have five different jobs over the years, five different focuses that you put on. There have been periods that I focused on undergraduate teaching, and periods that I focused on writing a book, and there have been periods when I've been in Europe, a number of them, periods when I focused very heavily on research, and periods when I focused on setting up WEMPEC that we'll talk about later. And in a sense, they were all, and a period when I was department chair, which was where I did very little teaching, although I continue to teach. So I have no misgivings whatsoever about having made that choice, and the university here has basically been very kind to me. Yeah, why don't you pause? One of the very interesting things that happened to me, very important things that happened to me early on, was right after I became an assistant professor. Professor Jim Skiles came to me. Jim is a faculty member in the EE department, who actually has played a significant role in my career here. His name will come up several times. But he came to me, and I think it was 62, might have been 61. He had just been appointed director of a new office in the university called, which was given the name of University Industry Research Office. Really, it was something set up by the Board of Regents, essentially based upon a question from somebody who said, how come the ag school is so active with farmers and ag business in the state, and they're helping them all the time, and the rest of the university seems like they're stuck in Madison? And that's very roughly what started it. But anyway, this office was set up to try to improve the interaction between state industry and the University of Wisconsin, particularly Madison. And Jim Skiles was made director of the program. And he came to me and said that they would would I be interested in becoming having an appointment with UIR, which would be a part-time appointment, which would give me some release time from the EE department. That is, the office there would pay part of my salary, so the EE department didn't have to, and some travel funds, and that my job would be to travel around visiting industries in the state that were in the same field that I was interested in, mainly machines and controls, etc. And to me, that seemed like a golden opportunity because, well, first of all, I was a young assistant professor who never had an industry job except for that one summer at aerospace. Secondly, there were all kinds of companies around the state that were in the business of motors and motor controls, etc. And so I decided to do it. And now this was very early. I think the UIR had just begun, so nobody knew how to do this. So I, first of all, got on the phone to a number of major companies and finally got through to somebody and said I wanted to visit to find out whether or not there was anything the university could do to help them. Well, most companies, most of the people fell off their chair, you know, figuratively, and really wanted to know, you know, well, what do you really want money, don't you, or something like that. And I said, no, we're just trying to find out how we interact. Well, I set up appointments and I visited companies such as Allen Bradley was a major one that I visited, Eaton Corporation, also in Milwaukee, Marathon Electric in Wausau, and Miller Electric, which is a manufacturer, a very large manufacturer of welders, they're up in Appleton. And many smaller companies whose names I don't recall anymore. Many of them had one engineer, and he did everything from design the product to design the machine that makes it to design the box that it's packed in to write the instruction book before it's sold.
Wow!
And I got an extremely broad education as to the nature of the electrical manufacturing industry in Wisconsin. And I think made a lot of friends around the state because many of these people that I met were the same people that helped me to found WEMPEC nearly 20 years later, 18 years later. But what I learned in these interactions also gave me a lot of input for the WEMPEC program. I think it's extremely important for engineers, engineering educators, to understand engineering industry. After all, that's where all of our, not all, but 90% of our graduates are going to go. Many people feel that every engineering educator should spend some time, you know, 5 years, something, in an industrial environment. And I personally would find that somewhat counterproductive, not counterproductive, but somewhat redundant. That's more time than you need. And furthermore, you're better off seeing, I think, a dozen or 15 companies than you are seeing working at one for a long time. At any rate, I found this activity to be professionally very rewarding, a lot of fun. These one engineer companies particularly amazed me because these fellows were extraordinarily broadly based. What they didn't know how to do, they learned how to do, you know, if it meant making a box or something like that. They were also the ones that I could help very often because many times they need a reference. One of the things UIR set up is an easy access arrangement so people could access the WENT library to get technical articles. And sometimes that's all they need. Sometimes they would, after we got to know each other, they felt no qualms whatsoever in telephoning me and saying, everything's been going fine and all of a sudden my glue doesn't stick anymore on the production line. These things are falling off. Do you have somebody up there who knows something about polyvinyl chloride adhesives? And I would make some calls to the chemical engineering department and do the best I could and give them back somebody who would talk to them on the phone. And UIR did that sort of thing for many years, supply answers to questions for companies. In addition to many other kinds of things.
Without charge?
Without charge. Now, if they needed somebody for a week's consulting, then the UIR got out of it and just let the individual faculty member work as a consultant. For that company. But many times it was a matter of just answering over the phone. It wasn't something you had to work on for weeks. Oftentimes, the answer is here on campus in somebody's mind, and you just have to find the right person.
Can I ask something like that? Yes. Who conceived of the UIR?
Was conceived by a committee that was set up by the Board of Regents back in the late 60s, early 60s.
Oh, okay.
And it was modeled a little bit after the engineering or the Agricultural Experiment Station. The Ag School already had a model, something like this, where they could reach out and help. In the larger companies, UIR often facilitated setting up a research project, so on. But for the smaller companies, it was mostly information. One of the things that I did with some of these larger companies was to set up with them a day when they would come to campus, and I would find here the half a dozen faculty members that were closest to the an area of expertise to their areas, and then we'd have a sort of a one-day mini conference where we got to know each other, and did many of those. I did this for about 4 years, as I recall, and built up a large clientele of people in the state that knew me and knew the EE department and knew the UIR program and felt quite free to call up for help. Never really felt put upon. That is, I never really felt that people were, that I was being taken advantage of. They were very reasonable about that. At one point, I stopped setting up things by phone calls, and I wrote a letter and sent it to about a dozen companies. And I remember that all but one of those companies responded favorably. And the one company, turns out the one company that didn't is now out of business. I don't think there's any connection, but there might be. At any rate, I really have to get onto this tape and onto this message that the UIR program was an extraordinarily beneficial thing to me early on in my career. And I think was a big help to state industry. There is an interesting thing, the change in the thought of the College of Engineering and the EE department, maybe the EE department in particular, of a much heavier emphasis on research, and therefore perhaps putting less of a positive weight on the kind of thing I was doing here, because at the time I did it, over those 4 years, it did not provide any research to me. No funding. No funding came out of those first few years, I don't think. Maybe that's wrong. There may have been one project with Marathon, but not much. And that wasn't my goal. My goal was to really get a feeling for state industry, and if some researchy topic came up, that would be fine. I think it might be that this would be looked upon as not a desirable activity for an assistant professor at the present time, because an assistant professor has only 6 years to develop a record strong enough to convince the faculty that he or she should receive tenure, and saying that I went out and met and helped 25 companies would, I don't think, in the present state of affairs, count very much. At the time, it did. At the time, it did, because the feeling that the department should increase its ties with state industry was very strong. It's largely a matter of, who's on the faculty. At that time, many of the faculty felt very strongly about industry interaction. And we worked very hard to increase the amount of activity that related to working with industry. Let me go a little bit further. I graduated my first advanced degree in 1963. Master's degree to John Granger, who's now a professor at NC State and has been for many years. John also stayed on and earned a PhD. It was an interesting thing because John, my first MS graduate, first PhD graduate, was actually older than I was by a couple of years, but
weird.
Just an unusual thing. And then in 1963, a very nice thing happened. The department had nominated me, and I was selected to receive a KECO for Teaching Award. This was an all university teaching award. They had about, in those days, about four of them. And it was a very important thing to me personally because I worked very hard on my teaching.
Wait, the forum for the whole university?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And they it turned out to be an important thing in my promotion to associate professor because teaching was given a lot, I think, a heavy weight in those days.
Did they have student evaluation forms back? I mean, how did they...
They had student evaluation forms, but they were not required.
Their decision on...
I had used them because I felt them to be useful for me as feedback to improve my teaching. And they were submitted, I think, along with this. But I had also... I was working on a textbook at the time. That went in. Some of the... there were letters from faculty and letters from students... talking about my teaching, and all of which was added up and became a case that was accepted by the department and by the divisional committee. And actually, promotion to associate professor with tenure is the most important recognition to an assistant professor that there is. You know, it means that the faculty has decided, okay, you're good enough to be one of us.
How old were you at this point?
64. I was 30. I guess I was having some misgivings along those. You know, if one isn't promoted in a reasonable period of years, you leave. And although this was very early, I had only been 3 years in the assistant professor position. It was a very early promotion and very, very much appreciated. I really felt now like the department liked what I was doing, and even though I was doing some things that were a little bit oddball, UIR was a kind of an oddball thing. I was the only one doing it in the department. There were others doing it in the college, but I was the only one in the department. The other important thing about the Kiekhofer Award was it had money. I think it was $1,000, which was a lot of money. And also, we had just gotten some money as an advance on royalties. And all of a sudden, I had this chunk of money, and so we went out and bought a house. Okay. So I finally, after all these years, at age 30, yeah, put a down payment on a house, 10% down. Had at that time a terrible interest rate. I forgot what it was, but. But it was a house that I had. We were renting a house, and I had written down all the things I liked about the rental house and all the things I hated about the rental house, and then made a list of all the things I wanted in my house, and the house we found had it.
Was this the one on East Skyline? Yeah,
had everything I wanted at the time. So we bought it, even though my wife said it was the most nerve-wracking thing I ever did. That is, I was the most nervous individual. That was the most I appeared to her to be the most nervous I had ever been. I was, dropping out a lot. I had a chunk of money and I was giving it away. Yeah.